Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thanks for being here. I appreciate you showing up. It is a lazy Sunday morning, and I'm determined to do as little as possible today. So that's my plan. But I still wanted to sit down here and check in with you and see how you're doing. Hopefully you're checking in with you and figuring out how you're doing. It's a grand project to practice self-awareness and to be able to stay on top of all the mental processes that we got going on. We're all very complex creatures. This rational reasoning thing that is our brain and is a piece of our consciousness. There's a lot of other parts of our consciousness that creates an even more complex composite of being. And that's really what I'm interested in talking about here on my show, The Gingerbread Man, is what it means to be. What are we all here as living creatures doing our best to maintain or subsist? These are all heavy words that carry a lot of baggage with them. In the Nietzschean camel way. So that's an old storyism, aphorism, that I shared several months back. Maybe even longer than that at this point. So I might as well reshare it. It's this concept of metamorphosis, which comes from a book called Thus Spoke Zarathustra by a man named Friedrich Nietzsche. He was a German philosopher, and he was a crotchety old fart too. But I like a lot of his philosophy because his way of penetrating into his own individual experience taught me some methods, or at least some willingness to try methodology in order to look into and discover parts of who I am and my own metamorphosis or evolution or any other sort of metaphorical concept that could be used to describe our movement forward. We're moving forward towards something, and it's hard to picture what that is, you know? But in one way or another, we're moving towards death. So we have this finite system and time frame to be able to do this work. And I think it can make our lives feel so much more valuable and fulfilling when we have these meaning systems built. And the only person who can make meaning for you and from your perspective, from your unique perspective, the only person who can do that is you. And so Nietzsche's camel is the first life phase for his metaphorical man. And he was very cautious about depicting this metamorphosis as not being a template for every single human being. So in the beginning of the story, there's a dragon, and it's always unclear as to where the dragon fits into it. But in some ways, I almost think of it as the mother of the existent, the creature coming into being. And the dragon itself is this tremendous monstrosity that is fearsome and imposing and massive. And on its skin is written the words, "Thou shalt. Thou shalt do this. Thou shalt do that. Thou shalt be who we want you to be." And the "we" here is the societalized schism of groupthink. And it's very important to be able to think in the group and to be present in the group and to be mutually dependable, right? But this is the base framework that we're born into, is this list of norms and expectations for who we're all supposed to be. And so because of these norms birthed from the dragon, we have a hump. And this is the camel's hump. And this is what makes the camel have its appearance, is this feeling of burden from all the expectations from the outside, or from the perceivable outside, you know? It's that idea that we're separate from it, which is funny because we're all living in that assumption, and that creates this burden. But at some point, a lot of these burdens seem to fall apart as we divorce ourselves from meaning systems that are given to us in lieu of one that we could create for ourselves, if that makes any sense. So the camel walks and it trots through its burden, and a lot of people die as camels, is what Nietzsche says. A lot of people never decide to go outside of burden and outside the expectations of what it means to be human. And so certain individuals will refuse this idea of intention for who we are, and this refusal is the roar of the lion. And the lion has force behind it. It has its nobility, and from this nobility it creates its individuation. And by refusing the prescriptions of others, the lion takes a step towards creating existence. A lot of people, according to Nietzsche, would die in this state of refusal. And I see a lot of people like this in my life because I'm very fond of them. And it's the people who you see who are just sitting on the street corner yelling no to everything. You know, certain people are almost impossible to give any sort of help or a caring, compassionate word because their skin and their defense has calloused to such a point where it is impossible for them to hear outside of their refusal. And even if we, or you, or me, or whoever thinks they are a caretaker or is trying to be loving, this can appear to be a personal affront to our own efforts. And no one can really afford to take that personally in the grand scheme of things. And so always recognize a lion and respect it and see the nobility and see the reason why somebody's reached that point in their life phase, in their personal evolution. The last stage of metamorphosis is the one that I find the most endearing, however, and that is the state of the child. And the child has the capacity for cosmic affirmation. Affirmation being an acceptance for life. And on the other side of acceptance, I would say, is surrender, even though the connotation of surrender has a negative backload and it feels dirty to have to give up our individuation. But that is all of the resilience that has been brought on by the lion phase. And then to shed our outer exterior and to get rid of our defense in order to say yes again, in order to accept the plan of the ruling principle of nature, of the universal God, or the unanthropomorphized Tao, entropy, this state of change, time, all these sort of concepts that are unhearable from the vantage point of our isolated little I or me. Once we start to affirm existence and we start to listen to what the world has in plan, all sorts of things snap into place and come into being. And I would say things get easier. So I was reading a lot of Watts this morning, my favorite, Alan Watts, and I've mentioned him probably 100 times on the show. He was a teacher and a talker and a lecturer and an adventurer and a journalist of sorts, certainly of the psychic, and the interdisciplinary connections between science and spiritual faith and the different sorts of faith that divide between the Eastern and the Western mythos of our cultures and this planet. He was an immense inspiration to me when I was young and just beginning to hear about a lot of these ideas and these thoughts. When I was probably about 19 years old, I was in a really harsh period of my life, and I was using things in order to avoid existence. I was running away to something that I'd always done. I initially ran away into narratives and fiction. I loved reading stories and I loved reading fantasy because everything that I seemed to read was these amazing, like, sorry, I gotta go get my teapot. I hear my teapot. I'll be right back. But as I aged and I became harsher and I dug into my counterism, because feeling alienated from this type of society, I was confused. And I did what I'd always been doing, and a chemical hibernation of sorts seemed to be the only way for me to deal with my existence at that point. And funny enough, the beginning to the rest of my life and an initial crux of just very, like, this day was so important that nothing would ever be the same again. Like, I'm not sure I would be who I am if this day hadn't happened. But I was in math class. And I was in a community college at this point. And community colleges have this diversity in student population. There's a lot of older people and younger people. You have everybody from high schoolers to people in their 60s who have decided to go back to school again. And one of the older-ish people to me, because I was 19, but you know, he was probably in his 30s now. It wouldn't feel like that much older. But I was fresh out of high school, and this man comes up to me and was very aware of where I was physically and mentally at this point. And I was in a really shitty place in my head because I was dope sick and I was withdrawing and I had been vomiting and had been catching sick in between virtually every class at this point. And so I was pale and I looked sick, and he comes up to me and he goes, "Hey man, you know, you look pretty dope sick." And I was like, "Oh, blah, blah, blah." And he's like, "But I have something that I think can help you." And I was immediately curious, because any sort of novel experience, and to me, I thought at first he probably just had more dope, but I decided that I was going to go out on this and see what he had to show me. He's like, "I have something that can help you." And so after class, I went with the dude and drove with his car down to an apartment on a not very nice part of town, not that it matters. And we walked into his apartment, and he had a wife. And the first thing he says is, "Honey, I brought somebody home to try the DMT." And I swear, for me, I think this was the first time he mentioned what we were doing. And I was very excited just immediately at this point. And I'm just like, "Oh, fuck yeah," right? And so he pulls out this gigantic oil burner, which is, you know, like, I don't know if you know what a liquid incense burner looks like. You can Google it now. But a lot of people have a really negative attachment to it because they immediately think of its connections with crystal methamphetamine. But I've used the exact same burner to use on psychedelic compounds for ever. And I know I've told the story before, so if you've heard it, bear with me. It's still a very important story to me. And Yeah. So he puts in a very large dose in this pipe, more than I've ever given anybody, more than I've smoked ever. It's probably the most I've ever smoked, really. And he had intentions to knock me out of my shoes. He wanted to shock me. In mystic culture, they call it a heroic dose when you take, like half an ounce of mushrooms or some just large, you're trying to push yourself past your level of comfortability. And he saw a sick boy and he thought that this could help. And he was right. It showed me a lot. I fell into this black space that felt like infinity. And there was nothing in any direction, anywhere. And my sense of body consciousness was nothing, like this nothing soup inside an egg. Like there was a shell, a membrane between me and the outside, but the outside was nothing and black at this point. It was void. And I was shown visions of myself abusing myself, and I was shown visions of my possible futures and the state of my body physically, where I would be. I saw a vision of me going inside my veins and all of my veins turning black, And I felt disgust for the abuse, and I felt an immense pity for me because I felt this separation between who I was at certain points in this experience. And I looked down upon this egg thing, and I saw all the things that it was going through and all the things that it was manifesting. And I felt immense pity for maybe one of the first times in my entire life. I felt genuine sadness for my state, because up until then, any and every action that could take me away from who I was and make me forget existence was more forthright than being in existence and living it and accepting who I was. And so, in order to feel sadness and feel guilt and shame for an experience, I had to accept that I wanted love for myself. This is one of the first times that I'd ever experienced that. And, I'm not sure if recently after that or just before that, it had to be after this, about a month after this, because I was clean by the time that my son was incepted. But like right after this was when my son was, the idea of him came into existence, when the pregnancy test came and everybody knew that a baby was coming, Like all this happened in a very short time, this transformation in my consciousness and the way that I looked at myself and what I knew I had to do for my future, and then my actual future in my world massively changing with this new child coming to me when I'm massively aware of how childlike I am, right? And it was at this point, like maybe in the same week, that the guy who showed me this tremendous magical substance, this medicine that forced me to crawl up a tier on the ladder of my own self-ascension, he gives me this book by Alan Watts called The Joyous Cosmology. And that book shook me, really. And The Joyous Cosmology is basically a journal of Alan's own psychedelic experiences. And looking at how he rationalized his own symbols. Because when we're in these heavily skewed, these different pages of who we are, like a prism, like if we shine light through a prism, usually our consciousness is shining as pure, unambiguated white light, because all the aspects of who we are blending together and working in this way in order to create perception, in order to create cognition. Because we have all of our sensors, we have all of our ears and our eyes and our nose and our tactile sensation and our vestibular sense, and all these physical mechanisms used to collect our environment. And then these have to go through the screen of mind, as mind is actively using these units of sense to make everything sensible. But without mind, without the consciousness, without that awareness, none of this would be crunchable. None of this would be cognizable. No existence would be the way that we perceive it. So everything outside of that is very different. And when the prism is put in place, which is what these chemicals seem to do, that I think that they seem to do, is you're able to see clearly parts of you. You're able to clearly see pieces that you usually can't see, the mechanism that is happening. And this can be very, very good for outside work in the waking consciousness. So in psychedelic circles, they call this process integration, which is why a lot of people would say don't be stoned all the time. Because if you're always high, if you're always microdosing constantly, or macrodosing, I don't know what the fuck you're doing, but if you don't give yourself time in waking consciousness to integrate what you learn from these very novel, different states of mind, then a lot of the work can be lost in reality. And I've been thinking a lot about my past and how these key moments when I was, to me, it seems just a lot younger, how much impact they had and how everything fell into place almost perfectly. And it's shocking and it's scary. And this is part of what has helped me feel more confident in having faith in existence and having faith in this universal principle. You know, I'm still avoiding the word God because it still doesn't feel like something I could talk at or talk to. And as Alan was saying in his book this morning, you know, the idea that we're separate from it, that we're separate from reality, that we're separate from nature, is this grand misconception. Like, we're active participants in it. We are nature, and we are making existence in our own little worlds. But we also have an impact on every single person that we ever come in contact with in our circles, in the people you work with your family, heavily with your children. You have a massive impact on your children and then your children's children. These are generational impacts that are going to affect the whole world. And so that's one of the things that I always want to solidify here in these episodes, is I want you to know that you have a massive impact on your own meaning systems. And through creating meaning, you create your world. So go and be creative. Go be artistic with your life. Every single choice, every single new moment is you. And not in the hippy-dippy hoodoo bullshit sort of way. Like, it's not just about going with the flow. I'm sorry about all these water noises too, speaking of flow. But it's not just about non-action and non-doing. It's not about just being lazy. It's not just about being complacent. Listen inside. There's a voice deep inside that is very wise, that is very infinite. And it's the same universal, natural, I keep saying the same fucking shit, the ruling principle idea. And it's this idea that was in Marcus Aurelius's book, and I've been reading a lot of it, and so it's stuck in there, it's pervasive. But this Tao, you know? And I hate that the subject matter that I'm trying to talk about is almost impossible to put in words. But I know that you feel it sometimes. And there's modern words like synchronicity. Like, look up that one. Synchronicity is this idea that's bound up with like The Secret and manifestation, which is just these old ideas being reinterpreted through new modern conceptology. You know, but The law of attraction. That's another one. You know, that if you think it, you're going to make it come into being. And if it's shit, you're going to bring shit in. If it's, you bring in really nice, sparkly gold stuff, you're going to bring in nice stuff. You know? But mind and our thoughts and the world are intrinsically and necessarily combined. And you can't separate them. Whenever one thing happens on one side of the equation, there's going to be a change on the other side of the equation, because the equal sign is a myth. Well, it's not a myth. We can use it because obviously we can balance shit out, but the scales are always fucking balanced. Everything is always as it's supposed to be, even when it's challenging and hard. And sometimes that's the lesson for the day in the schoolroom of life. You know, and that pisses me off to say it, because like, whenever I'm bitching and moaning, Odin will always come up and tell that to me, because it's something I probably say to him when he's having a hard time. But I'll say, he'll just come up and be like, "That's just life, Dad." And I'll just be like, "Oh, man." But he's right. He's right sometimes. A lot of the time. But I think I've rambled enough for today. I apologize if my voice has been kind of scratchy. I'm getting over a respiratory infection and I've been laying down and resting a lot. But I still wanted to uphold this commitment. This project is a plea to be helpful. I want to help you. I want to be available for anybody out there that feels like they're lost in this world because they're disattached from their meaning systems. I want to be an ear for anybody who needs a friend. And I want to be an outlet for information that has changed my life and had an effect on me. I want to share things with you that I hope you know is really accessible. Most of these things that I read are old as hell. And so copyright laws only work for like 60 to 100 years. So if you're reading something that's like 1,000 years old, it's probably free access on the internet at this point. You know, or you can Google somebody talking it, the audio on YouTube. You know, so like a lot of these old quotes that I'm about to share here in just a couple minutes, you know, like these thinkers had a massive effect on how I decided I wanted to build meaning and approach my reality. And having this sense of purpose and value through my own creation has helped save me. And I want to share that with anybody else out there. And so that's part of this infectious creative spirit that runs through the Gingerbread Man. And also love, unconditional love. Be loving, go be compassionate to this world and to the things that you come in contact with, even if it's a stranger at a gas station. But I could ramble forever and I could talk at a wall forever. I'd rather share some words of wisdom from some thinker. I haven't decided yet. I'll be right back. I'm reading from Alan Watts, Cloud Hidden, Whereabouts Unknown, a Mountain Journal, initially published in 1968. It's a collection of journal entries from his homes that he had in Northern California, I think. It was near Sausalito. He had this house on a houseboat, a ferry boat, and then he had a house on a mountain that was over the town that he would split his time between. And they were very different, but he found a lot of philosophizing to be done in these environments. And so today what I'll be sharing is from the third entry. It's called the Watercourse Way, which is one of his ways of depicting Tao, which is the flow of the stream. And I just really like this excerpt that I was reading this morning, and so I'm going to share it. Feeling all that I can possibly feel, aware of every level and dimension of experience, I find nothing but a streaming. If I ask myself, what is streaming? I cannot imagine an answer, even though I have the definite impression that it, some energy, some basic gazoozle, is streaming in every kind of stream. Streams of rock, streams of light, streams of air, streams of consciousness. This it is not different from the streaming, and its patterns as clay is different from the shape of this or that particular vessel. It isn't the stuff of which waves are made. There is simply no way of thinking or talking about it. And the significance of this is not so much that there is indeed some unthinkable and transcendent it, but that there is absolutely no way of standing outside it and getting hold of it. It could, of course, be myself, considered as the relatively enduring center of all my experience. But if this is so, myself is beyond my reach, and the more I try to pin it down, and the more it dissolves into the streaming, into various kinds of pulsing and texture, of tensing only arbitrarily distinguishable from the sights and sounds of the world outside of me. If this I should try to stop the streaming or to manage it at all, there's only a futile state of tension without the intended result. But this particular kind of tension against the stream is habitual, and the frustration which it engenders is chronic. If I believe that I would like to break the habit, that very wish is another form of the same tension, and this in turn is a form of the basic un-get-at-ability of it. We are all lunatics trying to stick pins into our own points, and it is thus that our frantic efforts to set the world to right and to extend our control over all happenings, inner and outer, are themselves the cause of most of our troubles. All force is tension against the stream. Everywhere there are now people absorbed in projects to change the world or to change themselves, and they will simply perpetuate or merely change the form of the very troubles they intend to avoid. That is not to say that all human life and conduct is inevitably a tragic mess. It is to say that human life, and all life, does not work harmoniously when we try to force it to be other than what it is, for the very simple reason that this is based on the assumption that I, who would control things, and something apart from which I would control. This is an assumption, is a hallucination, supported by the force of almost every universal social consensus. You, on the one hand, are responsible for what you do. On the other, to think or feel otherwise is taboo. It is called passivity, inertia, weakness, and spineless fatalism. But the most valuable insight comes through questioning the most obvious form of common sense. Gah, he's so fucking deep. I love it. He says a lot more fluently a lot of these ideas I was trying to describe. Perhaps we'll talk about it more later. I know I went through a lot of older ideas, not a lot of new information here. But maybe some of the best information is the stuff that needs to be repeated. And perhaps knowledge and wisdom is cyclical in it. Revolves around the staircase again and again and again as we crawl a little bit higher every day towards some sort of idea of truth, if that even is a thing. Well, I think I've rambled on enough. I'm gonna go grab Odo, see if he's got any advice for you.
Hello, guys. It's the gingerbread and Ask O. Here?
What you doing?
Well,
picking your nose?
No, I was not picking my nose.
I think you were.
I'm just telling you, if you pick your nose, do not eat your boogers because you're actually fighting against yourself. If you're asking why, it's because the air you breathe in sometimes have bad stuff. Doesn't mean you cannot stop breathing from out of your nose. You can still breathe out your nose. It's still smell. It's just blow out in a tissue.
Good advice.
Just do not eat it.
Thanks, Captain O. Well, we hope you have a great week. Bye.
Bye.